Welcome to this episode of On The Case, the LSE Law Society's podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Tan. In each episode, we speak to various professionals and experts to gain insight into legal careers, law school, and other exciting developments in the world of law. Without further ado, sit back and enjoy the show.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the first episode of the Where Law Meets Finance podcast series. My name is Shania Kapoor, and I am the team manager for LSE's On The Case podcast, one of the five divisions of the LSE Law Society. And we're working to execute our vision of increasing student awareness and accessibility to up-and-coming developments in the legal sector. The aim of this series is to provide listeners with a simplified yet structured understanding of the function of banking and finance groups at law firms, with a specific focus on leverage finance for today's episode. I have the privilege of interviewing Sarvajit Nag, a distinguished partner at Milbank, whose journey in the world of leverage finance has not only set new standards, but has also left an indelible mark on the industry. Sarvajit brings to the table a wealth of experience and an unwavering commitment to excellence with his profound understanding of complex financial structures, the regulatory landscapes, and the nuanced interplay between law and finance. In this episode, we have the privilege of delving into Sarvajit's remarkable journey, gaining insights into his experiences, perspectives, and the trends that define the industries he has contributed to so significantly. By the end, we hope to demystify the concept of leverage finance and spark your curiosity to delve deeper into the field. Welcome, Sarvajit. Thank you for joining us on our podcast series.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thank you for having me, Shania.
You have had a very interesting and exciting career. As I understand it, you came to the UK after completing your LLB from India, and you began your journey as a solicitor at a leading UK law firm, Allen & Overy. So since a lot of our listeners are international students, such as myself, looking to make their place at top UK law firms, I think it would be interesting to start by learning more about your journey in this legal sector.
So yeah, as you said rightly, I began my career at A&O in 2010. I went to law school at NUJS Calcutta, so I was there from 2004 to 2009. I graduated there at the end of 2009, joined A&O the year after. I think in a lot of ways, A&O sort of just happened to me almost by chance. It wasn't something that I planned for. You know, as you might know, back in the early 2000s, corporate law wasn't really as much of a thing in India as it is now. And certainly foreign law firms weren't hiring in the way they do now, and the market was a lot more closed to international students. It just so happened that in my penultimate year, some of the foreign law firms, especially A&O, Clifford Chance, Herbert Smith, they started to come on campus, really, I think, with a view to building their India practices, with the idea of the market opening up to foreign law firms at some point. And I was fortunate enough that year to have landed a training contract with A&O. It was a difficult year to graduate. It was after Lehman had crashed, and the market actually wasn't that great for law graduates. So I was very lucky to be one of the very few who managed to find a good placement. And I actually came to A&O without any real understanding of what A&O was. I'd only really heard of them in passing from the interview process. I never really knew what the magic circle was. When I joined A&O, there was very few of us from similar backgrounds to myself. I think 55 of us, and I was the only international student. So it was a very, very different world to what it is now. Sitting here now, looking back at the last 13, 14 years, it was impossible to predict how the market would have grown for international students as the way it has. It was a very different world back then.
I think your journey perfectly reflects how the UK legal sector has actually changed across the past 10 years. You came at a time when the legal profession, like you said, may not have been as diverse and as inclusive as it is today. How would you describe your experience of breaking into this system as an outsider of sorts?
I think it was very daunting, not because people made life more difficult for outsiders, but just because it was daunting in terms of being able to face, you know, not just the challenge of a new job, but a new country, a new environment. I remember coming to London, I think on a Sunday evening, and joining in on a Monday morning, having never been to London before. So it was daunting in a number of different ways. The lesson for all outsiders really is that when you first join a place, the initial transition period is always hard. But the one thing I will say about London, especially, and big firms like Milbank or A&O, they're very, very meritorious. That probably counts more than anything else. And that's what I found in my career. If you have the basic principles of, you know, being intellectually curious, being hardworking, and all of the other things that come with being a good lawyer, the industry does reward merit, I think.
Well, I'm glad you decided to stick around in the UK because I think your journey serves as a real inspiration for us, especially international students who are looking to break into this new system and coming from another country and another jurisdiction altogether. Now, given this move towards increasing diversity and inclusion, obviously you've seen certain changes in the past 10 years. Are there certain moments that stood out to you that you thought highlighted the profound change that has occurred?
I actually wouldn't think so. I would say, interestingly enough, given my background, the diversity wasn't really a focus for me when I was coming through the ranks, which is I know it's a weird thing to say because it probably should be. But I think I was fortunate enough to work in an environment where I did see people mentoring me in the same way as they would mentor anybody else of any other background. I was fortunate to have mentors who were very neutral and, again, very merit-driven in that sense. I think, look, diversity is a permanent part of our legal landscape right now. And I would say we're probably in the transition phase where people talk about diversity, which means that we're not actually there. I think the natural succession point and the natural transformation point would be the point at which people just stop talking about diversity. And obviously, we're not there yet. But I'm actually very fortunate to work in a firm that is quite diverse. And, you know, I like to say it's because we've thought about diversity before anyone else, but that's actually not true. I think it's because we are very merit-driven and we have senior partners who really just mentor people based on merit. So for instance, in the Global Capital Markets and Leverage Finance team, I think we are 70-80% diverse, which is a remarkable stat for a big law firm in London. Part of that is people being focused on merit and being lucky enough to have, for instance, good female associates who got made partner without having to focus on diversity. For us at the senior level, diversity is less topical in the sense that we don't talk about, we have to change this number, we have to change this stat, because I think we're there in a very meaningful way in terms of diversity. But I think the next transformation point is going to be for the industry where maybe hopefully in 5-10 years time, diversity is not really spoken about, it's a given. The other aspect of diversity, which is probably less true for our industry than for other industries, is social mobility, I think. The social mobility within this country definitely needs work. And I think if you look around the legal system generally, there's not a huge amount of examples of people coming through from the slightly more underprivileged parts of the UK and having made partners at big law firms like us. So I think the social mobility aspect definitely does need a lot more work. Diversity, I think, is probably one step ahead in that curve, whilst obviously clearly not perfect.
Yes, and I think a lot of our listeners would actually appreciate hearing about this perspective on how there has to be some sort of connection between a merit-driven approach and a social mobility, diversity, and inclusion approach. Like you said, Milbank has done that really well, and it has been doing that for decades now. I just want to circle back to what you mentioned earlier, and I think it ties well into our next topic, which is delving into your area of expertise. So you have advised on some of the most significant leverage finance transactions in the European market. But before we get into the specifics of your work, I think our listeners who may not know about this term, it would be beneficial for them if you could provide a brief description of what leverage finance actually entails and why it's a crucial component of the financial landscape.
Sure. Well, I think the easiest way of describing leverage finance is to compare it to someone buying a house. So let's say you've got £100 to invest somewhere. You're going to be able to buy a bigger house if you use 100 of your own money and get 200 off someone else's money and buy a bigger place. Or you might take that 100 and you might say, actually, you know what, I'm going to use 50 of that and then 50 more of debt and then be able to buy this one house. And I'm saving up 50 more to buy a second one with 50 more of debt. So the simplest way of explaining LEFFIN is it's a way of leveraging one's equity with debt. And that's all it is. And it is an absolutely fundamental part of not just UK, but Europe and the US and other parts where private equity plays a big role in driving M&A volume. The financial market itself is driven a lot by private equity in the ecosystem we live in. And this is how private equity basically leverages their equity and makes acquisitions. Private equity investments is so pervasive in Europe, for instance, that without getting leverage, that number would be a much smaller percentage of the market where it is right now. And the only way private equity is able to do this is, you know, if they're buying something worth 100, they would take 40 or 50 of their own cash, use 50 of debt, and leverage that up and actually make an acquisition and save up the equity for further acquisition down the road. That effectively then gives you a portfolio of assets you can manage. The key behind deciding what leverage you can get is the same principles as you would have for buying a house. So you basically decide, if I want a mortgage, how much of the interest payments can I support every month based on my salary or my wage? The same way the company looks at how much leverage can I support based on my cash flows. And that then determines how much debt you want to take on your balance sheet and how much equity you want to put in. So it's the same principles as one looks at when they're buying a house.
Thank you for that. I think you unpacked that in possibly the most simplest yet the most structured way I've ever heard. Because a lot of law students, such as myself, we read about such heavy banking and finance jargon when reading the FT or just other news articles to actually build our own commercial awareness. But hearing about it with the example you gave, I think it makes it a lot easier to understand. Given your experience in the banking and finance sector as a whole, what inspired you to focus on this specific area of leverage finance?
So I think my introduction to LevFin was entirely by chance. I was training at ANO, which obviously had a huge financing practice and still does. I happened to do a seat in leverage finance, in banking actually, in my second seat. And I got sat with a senior associate who really focused on LevFin. And that was my first introduction to LevFin. A bit like you, I had no idea what LevFin was. I loved what I did. And so I then did a secondment at Goldman Sachs in my fourth seat again, trying to kind of help the leverage finance bankers in executing deals, and then decided to come back to LevFin. What I loved about LevFin is what I still love about LevFin is that I find it really real. So we're working with businesses and companies that you can see around us. If you look around at the biggest LBOs in the last 3 or 4 years, they're all businesses that everyone would know. There's Asda, there's Morrisons, there's Birkenstock. There's so many brands they come across in our daily lives. And when those businesses tie into, you know, what you're doing in your work, I find that interaction really interesting. For me, working with businesses and working on deals which are real and tangible and which I know of and can see around me, that bit of leverage finance is really interesting.
I'd love to delve a bit deeper into that point. You mentioned deals and transactions in leverage finance. Could you possibly share an example of a particularly complex or innovative leverage finance deal you've been involved in and what made it stand out to you?
The one that comes to mind immediately is probably the Birkenstock leverage buyout, which was taken private or bought out by Al Katterton, which is a US retail-focused fund. The one thing on the Birkenstock deal we did, which was really interesting, is we used a syndicated term loan alongside what we call an asset-backed loan. And the assets in that case were actually the shoes themselves. So we used a stock of Birkenstock, which were lying in factories in Germany, as collateral to actually get what we call an ABL facility on that, where the amount of the loan given was roughly equated to the value of the stock itself. And that was one of the instruments we used to gain leverage. And that is quite unusual and also quite cool because my colleagues had to go to the actual warehouses and factories. People who worked on that found it really interesting looking at something which is so real, which is literally the shoes themselves. And then how it ties in with the legal backdrop. You know, you've got the AVL in place and you've got collateral over these shoes. Now, what do I do if the company actually goes bust? And then you start talking about the legal documentation. How do you enforce on that stock? And what happens with the value derived from that? And how does the security work? So all of those issues were really interesting and complex and also very real.
I'm guessing the due diligence process of actually going to the warehouses must be like a full-blown investigation into specifics. Yeah. And I can only imagine how fun that would have been. Delving more into the sector as a whole, given the deals that are going on at the moment or transactions at the moment, do you think that this sector presents new opportunities or challenges for lawyers and clients alike?
I think leverage finance is in a very interesting phase, has been for the last 18 months or so. So macro factors have a direct, almost dominant effect on leverage finance. So for instance, things like the war in Ukraine or the supply chain crisis or the commodity crisis, inflation, all of this has a real impact on leverage finance because effectively you're dealing with financial markets and the investors that invest in these instruments, whether it's CLOs, hedge funds, pension funds, credit funds, they're all exposed to the financial market in a very real way. So everything that's happened in the last 18 months, all of that has a real impact on leverage finance. In a very simplistic way, it means two things. One, the high interest rate means that companies are less able to support leverage because their interest costs go up and their cash flows have a direct impact on how much leverage they can sustain. Going back to my first example, if you had 100 of equity to invest and you can now no longer support 50 of debt because your interest rates have gone up and your cash flows are therefore strapped in a way that you can't support 50 of debt. And if the debt is now 30, which means private equity now has to put in 70 rather than 50, which means they might think actually, you know, the company is no longer valued at 100, might be valued at 80 or 90. So that has an impact on M&A as well, because you then start taking a view on valuations in the way that you otherwise wouldn't if you could get higher debt, for instance. So there is an impact of the rising interest rates in leverage finance and therefore on M&A. So all of this has a direct impact on leverage finance, which is again one of the really cool things about the industry. everything you see in the FT or any newspaper, for instance, about the economy as a whole, the macro factors that affect, you know, regular people's lives, actually have a real impact on Leftfin. And then in terms of opportunities, look, I think there's always opportunities that present themselves when the market gets a bit fragmented or a bit more difficult to operate in. What I mean by that is deals get more complex. People appreciate legal structuring, legal advice, legal notes, probably more than they would otherwise when the market is completely normalized. So I think there is an opportunity there as well where you can differentiate yourselves from competitors by thinking out of the box a little bit more, or, you know, having more brain power in terms of some legal structuring issue that someone else didn't think of. And that then I think differentiates the market as well. For a lot of us, including myself, because I joined the profession after Lehman, this is the first real cycle we've seen where you've had to think from the other side of the equation, which is what happens when things go wrong. Obviously, we think of that all the time, but in a more meaningful way, we're actually looking at situations in our daily work where things actually have gone wrong. And I think it's the last time since the GFC, but this has really happened. And, you know, that, again, throws up interesting legal issues, which are both challenges and opportunities, I would say.
Speaking of things that have gone wrong, I know that given the market volatility and constant fluctuations, it's very difficult to predict the future in the industry. But if you were to sort of give your predictions of, say, the next 3 years, how would you describe the market outlook in this particular sector?
I think the financial markets, not just leveraged finance, but financial markets generally operates in ups and downs, right? You go through cycles where there's a bull market and a bear market. So I think it is just a natural course of things, but I think it's probably a slightly longer market correction. And by that, I mean the medium term probably looks a little bit more challenging than one would ideally like. Obviously, I don't have a crystal ball, so I can't tell you when we come out of this. But I think, you know, the prediction is that interest rates will start normalizing by the end of this year. The macro factors are very hard to predict, but, you know, we are going through a cycle where I imagine the next 2 years or the next maybe 18 months or so will remain a little bit more balanced than they otherwise would in terms of demand and supply. If everything remains as it is right now, you know, I would hope that by the end of this year, the interest rates stabilize. By the end of next year, they start coming down. And hopefully by 2025, we're back to where we were.
Right. Thank you for that. I think partners such as yourself, or any lawyer, for example, in the financial market sector, have to stay very on point when it comes to the news. How do you stay updated with latest industry trends and developments? And how do you practically apply this knowledge that you gain to your everyday transactional client work?
I think the best way of staying updated really is to have an interest in the subject matter. I think it's very hard to stay updated on anything which you don't enjoy. If you think of long-term careers, they are sustained by having an interest in what you do. I loved economics when I was in school. If I wasn't a lawyer, I would be something in economics, I think. And I love looking into businesses. And so for me, that is an actual area of interest beyond just work itself. But that's the only way really to stay up to date. I mean, you can try and be disciplined and try and read up on the news as a part of your work, but that is not going to be as helpful as actually finding a subject matter which you have an interest in. Then obviously, when you work in the industry, you will meet other like-minded people who have similar interests. So for instance, when we speak to clients, or when we talk about, you know, new deals with clients, and we talk about the market, and we talk about issues, and you get their perspective as well. And this, you also try and absorb from other people in the industry. So I think it's a combination of the legal news, but also market participants. But obviously, that happens more as you get more senior. I think for more junior lawyers, really the best place of getting your news is the news itself.
I think you touched on two very important aspects versus interest, like you mentioned, because it becomes physically very impossible to read a whole FT article when you have no idea or no interest in what they're talking about. And secondly, as you mentioned, to keep in touch with people who are working within the fields of your interest to get another perspective. You work at Milbank, which is obviously a leading US firm that has established a significant mark in the UK and has a reputation of handling the largest and most complex transactions in leverage finance itself. I think a question that's on a lot of our listeners' minds is, what is it actually like working for Milbank and leading in one of their most coveted practice areas?
If I had to summarize the experience in two or three snapshots, one I would say is something I said before, it is very, very merit-driven. That is really the one thing that counts in a place like Milbank. Milbank is a firm that's grown so much in the last 4 or 5 years that it's almost like a melting pot for people who've trained at different places, from different countries, from different backgrounds. So the one common thing that binds us together is what we're good at, which is our work, and that's all that counts. So it's very merit-driven and it's very entrepreneurial. What I mean by that is Milbank is a first-generation practice where the practice has been built by the people who are still in the firm. It's unlike the Magic Circle firms or some of the other big US firms in London who have been doing this for much longer than us. And therefore, some of their practice might be legacy clients. They may have been built by someone 20 years ago. But at Milbank, everything we built is first generation. So it's built by the partners in the team, not just me, obviously, but all the partners around us. And therefore, we are very entrepreneurial. We value that quality in all of our associates, the desire to get stuck in and actually build your own thing and work together and build something together. That is a really powerful thing in Milbank, which I haven't seen before. And the other thing I would say is it is genuinely collaborative. And that comes from the very top. The idea is that you can have three very good lawyers in the room, and that is better than having one very good lawyer in the room. But in my experience in the last 5 years, which is roughly, you know, when I've been at the firm, that's been very true.
I think you've touched on something very crucial that relates to the values and qualities that Milbank has and possibly looks for in prospective applicants as well. And I think that kind of leads nicely into the next segment, which is on advice for students who are looking to apply to Milbank, either for a vacation scheme or a training contract or just transitioning from another firm. We've discussed about merit. So I just wanted to understand how Milbank would define merit for law students who are looking to apply. What is that meritorious aspect that they're looking for in an application?
Yeah, look, it's a great question. For me, merit is this combination of aptitude and attitude. The attitude for me actually in some ways is almost more important than the aptitude. I think a lot of people that come to places like Milbank, you know, clearly have great credentials, great academics, great CVs. From an intellectual perspective, they're clearly very, very bright. So in a way, the academics almost are a given. So the attitude is, I think, what often ends up kind of distinguishing people, I think, at the very early part of their careers, which is the desire to get stuck in, being driven, very hardworking, intellectually curious. The X factor is this real willingness to make a mark and do something meaningful with your careers and having this hunger and strive for success. I think that is a rare thing. And for me, often when I see that, I think that goes a long way. I think those are the key elements that at least I would look at.
Thank you for that. I think that was a really interesting perspective for a lot of our viewers out there. And with that, we will end today's podcast journey. Thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your expertise on this important topic. I think we've covered a lot of stuff from leverage finance, your journey, Milbank. Thank you for taking the time out to share your insights with us. I think your journey has been a real inspiration for international and home students alike who are looking to make a place for themselves in this massive corporate law world. So thank you for joining us, and we look forward to possibly having you on our podcast in the future as well.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning into this episode of On the Case, the LSC Law Society's podcast. Further information and our contact details can be found in the description of this episode. Don't forget to follow us at LSCSU Law Soc on Instagram or on LinkedIn at LSC's On the Case. See you next time.